This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hi, I'm Rachel Wright, and on the Global News podcast, we're following the Emergency Defence Summit in Brussels to address Europe's security crisis. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. There's been another emergency defence summit in Europe today. European leaders were meeting in Brussels this time with more warm handshakes, back-slapping, even bear hugs. The clear message being European unity and solidarity for Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression and in the face of recent bitter US criticism. Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen was very clear in her message as she arrived.
For me, the most important thing now is to be very frank, to rearm Europe. And I don't think we have a lot of time. So rearming Europe, spent on defence and deterrence. That's the most important message. And at the same time, of course, continue to support Ukraine because we want peace in Europe and it cannot be done without a sustainable peace forward when it comes to Ukraine.
Well, Boris Pistorius, Germany's current defence minister, also repeated his country's support for Ukraine.
Ukraine can rely on Germany. For us, it is now a matter of looking for possible solutions to all the changes taking place internationally and acting with a cool head. The situation is serious and requires decisive and level-headed action.
Well, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked European leaders for their enduring support and commitment.
I want to thank all our European leaders for such signal strong support. Discuss on strong support from the very beginning of the war and during all this period and last week you stay with us and of course from all the Ukrainians, from all our nations, big appreciation. We are very thankful that we are not alone and these are not just words, we feel it.
But not all EU leaders are speaking with exactly one voice. Viktor Orban of Hungary held bilateral talks with President Macron of France today. Mr. Orban said that while he agreed Europe needed to spend more money on its defence, he didn't want to sign the final communique of the summit that explicitly supported Ukraine. And the response to all this from Moscow has been predictably negative. Vladimir Putin said that Russia would only make peace on its own terms. Speaking to women who'd lost relatives in the war, he said that any deal had to guarantee Russia's security.
We must choose a peace option that will suit us and that will ensure peace for our country in the long term. We do not need anything that belongs to others, but we will not give up what is ours. And we need such an option that would ensure the stable development of our country in conditions of peace and security.
Just before we came on air, I spoke to our Europe correspondent, Nick Beek. He's at the conference in Brussels and gave us an idea of the mood at the meeting there today.
You can listen to various European leaders, Rebecca, and they each seem to have their own phrase, 5 minutes to midnight, decision time, the critical moment, all underlining just what an important moment this is. But will the action follow this? They had President Zelensky with them today for this meeting, so if they needed to focus their minds, I'm sure he would have given a vivid account of the ordeal that his people continue to face with bombs raining down on Ukrainian towns and cities. The choreography today started with that warm welcome for President Zelensky, but then they got down to business. And these European leaders from the 27 countries in the European Union, they were looking specifically at really boosting defence spending across the continent, increasing the amount of manufacturing when it comes to weapons, drones, missiles, tanks, all of that sort of thing. But in the very short term, of course, they've got to try and work out how they fill this gap, which Donald Trump is leaving by suspending this military support to Ukraine. And of course, at the moment, people don't know whether this is a temporary thing or whether this is an indication of what he'll do for the rest of his term in office.
Yeah. And as you say, Nick, a lot of money is being talked about and also really ambitious projects for new high tech in military hardware. But how fast, realistically, are they going to be able to get any of this together?
We're not fast enough, I think, would be the simple answer to that. This is planning for the future. And if you listen to the leaders, they're saying it's a future threat from Vladimir Putin, among others. I mean, it's quite interesting. If you listen to what Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, was saying today. He is someone whose country spends more than 4% of their GDP on defence spending. But if there is any sort of peace deal, a ceasefire in Ukraine, he says he can't afford to send any of his soldiers there to be peacekeepers because of the threat, he describes, from Russia that they may invade Poland. So I think that's an indication of the level of concern. Certainly the Baltic countries are talking about the threat of Russian aggression. So it's really focusing minds, and they're trying to do two things here, really. They're trying to fill this immediate gap in light of what President Trump's done, but also they're trying to completely transform the landscape here. And like Germany, throw out the window some very tough rules on spending so that they can really increase spending on defence specifically.
And it does seem as if most of the European leaders, as well as the Ukrainians, of course, are being so careful with their language, especially in relation to the United States. And that's kind of in contrast to language we're getting from other diplomats. I mean, the New Zealand ambassador to London got sacked today after comments he made about Mr. Trump's knowledge of history. Then we had that quite stark warning from the Ukrainian ambassador to London saying that the United States was destroying the world order, which is kind of a bit off message from the tone coming from President Zelensky. Given the feeling in European countries, can the leaders maintain the discipline now for the diplomacy?
Well, I think it was really interesting listening to the leaders today. None of them mentioned President Trump by name, and certainly there was no criticism of him. You imagine, though, the conversations behind closed doors. So I think lots for the leaders to calibrate. And of course, the crucial thing is they don't have a load of time to do it.
So obviously there's a lot of unity within the EU, but not everybody's singing from the same hymn sheet. I'm just seeing a line here now. This is coming from Reuters news agency saying that the EU leaders agree a statement in support of Ukraine without Hungary. We know that Hungary does have quite a different stance on the situation in Ukraine. And I think Slovakia has also had some hesitancy.
Yeah, well, this is what everyone was thinking may happen. Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, is sympathetic to Moscow, has much warmer relations with President Putin than the vast majority of the EU leaders. And he said in the run-up to this summit that there's no way he could sign any sort of communication, any sort of statement which said that the EU would continue to fund and support militarily Ukraine for as long as it takes. And Mr. Orban was saying that the facts have changed, and actually Europe should be following the lead of Donald Trump. They should be ringing up President Putin, trying to strike a deal, not perpetuating this conflict. So he is very much the minority voice. So it may well be that if they've decided this without him, they've done this as a conscious decision in the past. He's left the room and decisions have been made. But he certainly has been the thorn in the side of many of the key EU leaders on Ukraine.
The BBC's Nick Beake in Brussels. Now, Spain is the fourth largest country in the EU by population and economic size, but for years it's been at the bottom of league tables on NATO member defence spending. Last year, it only spent 1.28% of its GDP on defence, a long way off the pledge of 2% for NATO members. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has said he wants to boost it to 2% by 2029, but given the circumstances, will that be considered enough? Spain's history, of course, may be part of the reason for reluctance towards military spending. The country was under Franco's dictatorship from World War II to 1975, and then there was that failed military coup in 1981. So will the current situation change that attitude? Well, Arantxa Gonzalez Laya was Spain's foreign minister under Prime Minister Sanchez between 2020 and 21. So why has Spain neglected its defence spending?
Well, first, let's get the facts right. Spain has not neglected it. Spain in the last 4 years has done a massive effort. And it's true that before that, there were difficulties. There was the 2009 financial crisis that crippled the ability of many economies, including the Spanish economy, to invest on anything, including the investments in defense. But I mean, I think if we look at the last 4 years, there has been a very big effort on the side of Spain, fully aligned with the objectives that Spain has taken under NATO.
Well, you mentioned the financial crash. That is something that affected everyone, not least Poland and Ukraine as well, as other Eastern European countries that have seen their military spending go up remarkably over the past few years. They wouldn't say that that was an excuse.
No, and I don't think it's an excuse, and I don't think the financial crisis had the same impact on every country. It didn't have the same impact on Germany as it had in Spain. It didn't have the same impact on Italy as it had on France. And therefore, every country has had to grapple with this. But I mean, it's not. Let's not look at the past. Let's look at what countries are doing. And in the case of Spain, Spain is clearly on that trajectory, especially because the situation now demands urgent action on the side of all members of NATO.
Well, will it be fast enough, though? Because Mr. Sanchez has said he wants to see it by 2029. But obviously, there is, as you say, a need for that to come sooner than that. There's a YouGov poll out today in Spain that suggests that around 57% of Spanish people surveyed said that they wanted Ukraine to win this war, that they were backing them, but only 18% said that Spain should increase the support it's giving to Ukraine. How is your government going to broach that gap?
Well, I think if you look at every poll that the European Union has done on support from Europe, including Spain, for Ukraine, it has been very clearly that Europeans understand that supporting Ukraine today is supporting Europe. And this is where I think they've understood that war in Ukraine is protecting also Europeans. And therefore, let's look at what has been done. Let's look at what these 3 years have given, which is constant support on the side of all members of the European Union to Ukraine, including, without exception, Spain.
Okay, what briefly percentage should Spain be spending of its GDP on military defence, briefly?
I think the clear target established for all members is 2%. And my sense is that we may have to revise this upwards collectively, because the threats are increasing. And when the threats are increasing and the risks are increasing, it's about the security of people. And that is where we should be putting also our efforts.
Arantxa Gonzalez Laya there, Spain's former foreign minister. Well, in the past few minutes, the US President Donald Trump has been speaking. He said NATO countries are still not paying enough.
The biggest problem I have with NATO, I really, you know, I mean, I know the guys very well. They're friends of mine. But if the United States was in trouble, and we called them, we said, we got a problem, France, we got a problem, a couple of others I won't mention. Do you think they're going to come and protect us? They're supposed to. I'm not so sure.
Donald Trump speaking within the past few minutes there. Still to come, amid those high-stakes trade tensions between Canada and the United States, we'll hear from a photographer who captured a photo that's now gone viral of a Canada goose fighting off the U.S. national bird, the bald eagle, in a fight to the death.
When I was taking the photographs, I was looking at it from a naturalist point of view. It was after I took the photographs and I heard people talk about them in the context of the political situation that I realized that there was so much more to those photographs than just what caught my eye.
More on that to come. Other headlines this hour. The Pope has broadcast his first audio message since being admitted to hospital and has thanked those who've been praying for his recovery. The Vatican says his health is stable. We'll be hearing from Rome later in the programme. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, as we were hearing in the news, Hungary's leader, Viktor Orbán, decided not to sign the final communique of the European Defence Summit in Brussels today that specifically reiterated EU support for Ukraine. He has, of course, attempted to block EU aid for Ukraine at various points throughout the war. So how united is the EU really? Slovakia is another country which doesn't always see eye to eye with other EU leaders. And I've been speaking to Katarina Roth Nevadalova, who's in the Slovak capital Bratislava. She's a member of the European Parliament for the governing Smer party, so she's aligned with the Prime Minister Robert Fico. What's her take on what's been going on in Brussels today and more generally the European view of the war in Ukraine?
Well, we can see that there was, in the end, the agreement. So it's a good position, I would say, as the European member of the European Parliament. I would say that it's good that we agreed on something as European Union. Well, every country has the sovereignty and they can decide if they like or not. So it's the full right of Hungary to have a different view than the other member states. So, well, you see that Slovakia is a good member of the EU. In the end, we agreed on these proposals because we had one issue which was very important for us, which was the continuation of the gas flow from Russia towards Central Eastern Europe and the security of the transit via the territory of Ukraine towards Slovakia, which we would like to move on. And that's basically in the final text of this agreement. So those were important for us. So we are there. So we could agree on the common statement.
Okay. I mean, a lot of people listening will say that European unity is key at this point. And you talk about the gas flow coming from Russia for Slovakia. But, I mean, you can see what's happened in Ukraine. What's your view on how Ukrainians might feel about the Slovakian position on this?
They should respect that we are the sovereign country and we need to protect our own citizens and our own interests and economic security.
Isn't Ukraine?
Of course they are, but they should also respect the other sovereign countries. And we were very clear about it, that what they did, their decision from the beginning of this year, undermined the position of seriously undermined the position of the several member states of the European Union concerning the energy security. So if they expect us to support them, they should also see our point of view.
Would you like your neighbours to support you if you were invaded by a foreign force?
Rebecca, we are supporting Ukrainians quite a lot. We are among the member states or the states in the world which supported Ukrainians totally with a huge amount of the money concerning how big country we are. We did send them a lot of arms. We did send them a lot of money. We support also Ukrainian refugees, which are now in the territory of Slovakia, which is more than 200,000 people living here. And we support them with the money and with different kinds of support. So that's not that we are not solidar. Mm. But this energy security is very important for the European Union itself. And this decision of the Ukrainians was totally political. And anyway, they are getting the Russian gas from a different part of European Union. So that was the decision which didn't make sense. So now we are in the position that, yes, that was very important for Slovakia to have this part in the statement, to have the energy security so we can continue in a way supporting Ukraine and the people who need it.
Do you trust Mr. Putin in Moscow?
I don't understand why are you asking the question? What is the correlation?
Well, in terms of you're talking about the gas supply, I mean, couldn't Moscow turn off your gas supply at any moment?
No, they couldn't, because we have the agreement. There is the agreement between us and Russians, and the supply is coming a different way, which is diversified via Turkey currently in this moment. So we are getting the supply via Turkey.
And that was Katarina Roth Nevadalova there, MEP with Slovakia's governing Smer party. Well, it is just over a week since the United States voted with Russia and North Korea against European allies at the UN, and just under a week since the now infamous Oval Office showdown with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Since then, there have been intense emergency defence summits in Europe, as we've been hearing. The US has suspended all military aid to Ukraine, and it was confirmed yesterday that Washington has also paused intelligence sharing with Kyiv. been a busy week, really. So positions have shifted and alliances have been strained. So how's Moscow viewing the rapidly changing diplomatic landscape? The BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
The global order is shaking. Alliances are changing. And so is the language. Living in Russia, there are two phrases I've got used to hearing officials and pro-Kremlin commentators coming out with when they lambast Russia's rivals. The first one is the collective West, a derogatory term normally aimed at America and Europe. The second put down is the Anglo-Saxons. That's when Moscow rails collectively against the US and the UK. At least, this is how it was for several years. But in recent weeks, I've been hearing and reading these phrases less and less. Perhaps that's not so surprising, though. After all, with Donald Trump in the White House, labels like collective West no longer seem to apply.
Не та Америка.
Instead, Russian state TV's flagship news show kicked off recently with a big strap across the screen declaring America's doing things differently. As it turns out, very differently. A few days ago, we saw the United States voting with Russia, North Korea and Belarus against a UN resolution that identified Russia as the aggressor in Russia's war in Ukraine. Now the Trump administration has paused military aid to Kyiv. By contrast, US-Russia relations are on the up. There have been discussions between Moscow and Washington on repairing diplomatic ties and talk of future economic cooperation. This week, one Russian newspaper described America as Russia's partner. It's just one word, but it represents a sea change. Not so long ago, Joe Biden was calling Russia the aggressor, and its president, Vladimir Putin, a murderous dictator. Last weekend, I heard something in the news here that brought home to me just how much things have turned around. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, went on TV and declared that America's new foreign policy configurations are largely aligned with Russia's. America and Russia, seeing the world through similar eyes? So where does that leave Europe? Potentially quite exposed, and certainly receiving most of the abuse. Let me bring you up to date with Russia's new set of labels. European countries that support Ukraine are described here as the old world. European leaders who back President Zelensky are referred to as the party of war, or the liberal globalists. Russian is a rich, colourful language, and I'm sure many more labels will be hatched soon. But there's one other thing that I've noticed. When Donald Trump won the presidency in 2016, some headlines in Russia referred to him as our Donald. Not this time. There's a little bit more caution here, just in case things don't work out. And what looks like being the start of a beautiful friendship turns sour.
The BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reporting from Moscow there. Don't forget the live page, all the details on the war in Ukraine and the ongoing diplomatic efforts to try to end it. Just do a search on BBC News.
Hi, I'm Rachel Wright, and on the Global News podcast, we're following the Emergency Defence Summit in Brussels to address Europe's security crisis. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. This evening, the Pope has released a message of thanks from his hospital bed. It's the first audio message since being hospitalised for double pneumonia nearly 3 weeks ago. I've been speaking to our Rome correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, who's in St Peter's Square as people gathered to pray for him in Rome. So is this news coming as a relief to the people there?
Yeah, I think you can hear the rosary prayers behind me here on the steps of St. Peter's Basilica. But the crowd that gathered here this evening, as they've been gathering every evening for the last couple of weeks to pray for the Pope, got quite a surprise this evening. The Cardinal who was leading the prayers started off by saying he'd been asked to share what he called wonderful news. He said this is a good day because the Holy Father had sent his greetings in person to the crowd. And then he played the audio message, a very short message, just 22 seconds
we've tape.
We have.
Any Spanish listeners can enjoy this. Here's a little clip.
De todo corazón, las oraciones que hacen por mi salud desde la plaza. Los acompaño desde acá. Que Dios los bendiga y que la Virgen cuide. Gracias.
There we go. And apparently he's thanking people for all the well wishes and prayers over the past couple of weeks. What did you think, Sarah? It sounded pretty good, really.
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, I think most people here, first of all, I think shocked to hear that message. I'm very grateful to hear it because, as you said, it's the first that anyone outside of, you know, the doctors treating the Pope and those in hospital have heard or seen of him at all in 3 weeks. So a lot of relief in that sense and a lot of surprise, but I think people will be worried too, because you know, you could hear the struggle in the Pope's voice. He said he was thanking people from the bottom of his heart for their prayers for his health, so he's clearly showing that he knows that people have been gathering every evening here and all around the world to pray for his health. He said he was here with them, he said he accompanied them, and he blessed them, and he said thanks again. He was speaking in his native Spanish, but I think, you know, even for Spanish speakers, it was quite hard to actually hear his words, to make out exactly what he was saying. And looking at people's faces in the crowd here who'd come to pray, I think people were mostly confused, but also relieved. There was a little round of applause as they realised what they were listening to, but it was so short, it was over almost before. I think people could really take it in, and the prayer's still going on, because I think people here know very well that the Pope is very poorly, and still praying for him.
Very briefly, Sarah, he has been trying to update people throughout his illness, hasn't he, one way or another?
Yeah, his doctors have been giving regular bulletins, and the latest that they've said is that he is stable, and he's been stable for a couple of days, which is a big relief for people here, because of course there have been regularly serious reports about him having breathing crises up until now.
And that was our Rome correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican, as people there continue to pray for the Pope, who remains in hospital at the moment. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Now, it's just 2 days since President Trump slapped tariffs on his neighbours, Mexico and Canada. Now, though, it seems he's done a U-turn. Donald Trump lifted the tariffs on Mexico today for a month. This is after a call with the country's leader, Claudia Sheinbaum. President Sheinbaum said that she'd presented Mr. Trump with data that showed her country's work towards stopping fentanyl from crossing the border. And that move seems to have had an effect with the White House. We can also hear what's happened with Canada now. I've been speaking to Erin Delmore. She's the BBC's business correspondent in New York.
Well, we are seeing some action today from President Donald Trump. He has indeed put into effect a reprieve on some goods coming from Mexico and Canada. They would be exempt from the 25% import taxes that he announced earlier this week. And in addition to the car industry exemption that he made clear yesterday. Now, if you're feeling a little bit of this back and forth, that's how American businesses and especially American manufacturers have also been responding to this news. And we're seeing it reflected in the stock market. Questions about which industries are affected, from which countries, at which tariff rate, and starting when, has stocks dipping down this morning on the uncertainty.
And, of course, there's a lot of discussion about the relationship between Canada and the United States, and particularly between the two men, Mr. Trump and Mr. Trudeau, who, it's reported in the Wall Street Journal today, had a phone call yesterday, this would be, that was really heated. What do we know about that?
Exactly. Well, we do know that the phone call included some harsh words that were exchanged between the leaders and also included reportedly some profanity. Now, We did see a little bit of tension reflected. If we think about what we've seen publicly, certainly we saw a fiery speech by Justin Trudeau of Canada, where he made clear to the American people, speaking directly to Americans, your government is doing this to you. We don't want to see you harmed economically, but this is being done to you by your government. Now, we can also look at another public action, rather than report on closed-door conversations and meetings, where we see President Trump shining a bit of a golden spotlight here on Mexico's leader, saying that they had a fruitful conversation, pledging to work together, talking about shared successes, especially to limit the border crossing of fentanyl, the illicit opiate that has led to many American deaths, and something that the president is very focused on and has really tied closely to the issue of tariffs as a retributive action toward North American countries that he says have allowed the flow of fentanyl.
So what we're hearing is that this suspension of the tariffs is for a month. Any talk about that being extended or what will happen at the end of that?
Well, we can take the context here because, no, we don't know what happens as of the 2nd of next month or what happens on the 3rd of next month. But we do know that we've already seen 1 month-long extension on these tariffs as well. Now, I have been speaking to American manufacturers, and in fact, I was reporting from the Toy Association's annual get-together in New York City. And from what I'm seeing, individual industries are appealing to the White House for individual exemptions. Think about all the industry across the U.S., because do you remember it's U.S. importers who are paying these fees when the imports cross into American borders? They cite the car manufacturer's success in getting the president to exempt them from tariffs. And they also talk about the nature of Trump changing his mind here, pointing to the TikTok ban, which was in effect and then was not. And these are things that American manufacturers have top of mind as they go one-on-one and lobby the White House for their own exemptions.
And that was Erin Delmore there, the BBC's business correspondent, speaking to us a short time ago from New York. Now, antibiotic resistance is a growing threat to health systems around the world, and scientists are constantly trying to find new antibiotics that can help. Well, now new research unveiled today points out how our own immune systems may be a goldmine for potential antibiotics. These findings have been written up in the journal Nature. Professor Yebat Mebel led the research at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and she's been speaking to NewsHour's Tim Franks.
We have what is called a proteasome, which is like a garbage can in each and every cell in our body. And this garbage can is responsible for degrading proteins that are obsolete, finish their function, or that are damaged. And what we found is a new immune mechanism that, in fact, generates antimicrobial agents by the products of these degradations of proteins. So it's like small pieces. Think of a recycling bin, if you will. What we found is that within the proteins in our body, when they are sent to this recycling bin, they actually generate little pieces of what people are now calling like natural antibiotics.
I mean, it's a wonderful image, the idea that you sort of delved inside these garbage cans, as you put it, and you've plucked out something from that garbage can, which what can then be used to attack particular bacterial cells.
Absolutely. So what we've done is that we took these little pieces, which are called peptides, even if you produce them outside and just test their effect on bacterial cells, what we found is that they're perturbing the membranes of the bacteria and by that causing them to die. And these are little pieces are in fact being generated all the time in our body. And this is something that we did not know before.
Well, I guess the possibilities are huge in that case. I mean, one thing, the fact that it's from within the body, presumably that will mean that fewer people, if this can be turned into antibiotics, fewer people would have resistance to or side effects from those antibiotics.
Absolutely. And you touched upon one of the key advantages. You do not react to them. And again, I don't want to generalize because it's only the beginning and this, you know, finding is now being highlighted in Nature and so on, but there is plenty to do until we get into the clinic. But there should be potentially more safe because they do not alarm our immune system as something that is foreign. And so if this is indeed the first line of defense, what we showed in the paper very nicely is that if you provide one such piece from the outside, even in mice model of, let's say, bacteremia and pneumonia or bacteremia that causes sepsis, that little piece provided as a treatment can actually protect the mice not only from death, but also really has amazing effect on the tissue damage and reduces all of the inflammatory responses.
I mean, you mentioned a couple of fairly sort of big ticket bacterial infections that you were able to test this new method on, but have you got any insight as to whether it might also be used against the things that are called superbugs, these microbial strains that are seen as, I mean, lethal, but also utterly resistant to the sort of antibiotics that we've got right now?
So, of course, it's too early to know whether that will have the same effect in humans, although the peptide that we chose is exactly the same in mice and humans.
Right. It's a way to go until potentially we get to humans. Can you just tell me what the next stage of this research could be?
Oh, absolutely. This research opens up so many doors because we didn't just identify one such peptide. We identified hundreds of thousands of such peptide, and we still don't know whether we tested them in combination, but we still don't know which bug will be responding to which type of peptide. So we can try now to do a lot of combination analysis. We can then test and ask how it may impact different diseases such as autoimmunity and fibrosis. And it's relevant even beyond infectious diseases in many cases in which we have what we call immune compromised patients, meaning patients that undergo transplantation or cancer patients that may have perhaps a suppressed immune system. This is something that potentially, once we show a proof of concept in humans, may provide a shield, a line of defense that will be missing.
Some exciting news there from the world of science. That was Professor Yerbat Merbel from the Weizmann Institute in Israel. Now, butterflies are very popular insects, of course. Not only are they really pretty to look at, but their transformation from wriggly caterpillars through the chrysalis process to elegant, fluttery beauties has captured the imaginations of many an artist and writer. It's very sad, then, to learn that their numbers have declined sharply in the US in the past 20-odd years, according to new research published in Science Journal. Put it this way, for every 5 butterflies at the beginning of this century, there are now only 4. So what's the impact of this and why is it happening? Eliza Grahams is Assistant Professor in Biological Sciences at Binghamton University in New York. She's one of the authors of the research. So why the drastic drop in numbers?
There are a lot of different drivers of butterfly declines and insect declines in general. We weren't able to connect specific drivers to individual species trends in this study, but there were some patterns that emerged that give a signal as to what might be behind the declines. We saw really steep declines in the Southwest, which is one of the warmest and driest regions in the U.S. and has also been warming up and drying out at quicker rates than other parts of the country. And so that's a potential signal of climate change and especially drought. Drought is sort of a double threat to insect populations because they have such a high surface to volume ratio, and then it also affects their host plants, so reducing the amount of food that's available to them. Right. We also saw potentially a signal of climate change in the Northeast, where many species are decreasing more severely in the southern parts of their range than the northern parts. And then the other kind of key thing that came out is that it looks like insecticides in the Midwest are kind of the key driver of declines, more so than habitat loss or climate change or any other driver.
Okay, so most of this research has been done in the United States, but I guess this is an issue across the world. What is the impact of losing butterflies and other insects? What role do they play in the ecosystem?
Well, yeah, as you said, they inspire us, right? I think butterflies are really wonderful because they give humans a connection to insects, which can be more difficult to see with other types of insects. But also, yeah, as you point out, they're really important for ecosystem function. They're pollinators for so many of our wildflowers and other plants. They're also herbivores. So in their caterpillar stage, they're really important in terms of keeping plant populations in check. And then they're also food for insectivores like birds.
Mm. And so in terms of what could be done, if we're saying that climate change could be one of the main reasons why their population has declined, is there anything that we could do to maybe try and slow that decline down?
Yeah, I think absolutely addressing climate change is one of the things that's key to addressing the biodiversity crisis. But that's a really difficult thing for individuals to have any control over. And I think one of the wonderful things when we're talking about insect conservation, and especially butterflies, is that there's small actions that individuals can do in their own backyards that really do have a big impact on population trends. Butterflies are already kind of living on the edge of a knife in terms of really high mortality rates at early life stages. So anything that we can do to improve habitat and reduce mortality early on has a big impact on the population, and they can bounce back. This is things like leaving sort of a messy yard, not mowing your entire backyard because that leaves more flowers available for pollinators, planting native wildflowers, and then, of course, supporting policies that benefit insects.
And any particular plants that are very attractive to butterflies that you could maybe plant in your back garden as well?
Yeah, it depends on where people live. So in the U.S., you want to plant the native species that are native to where you live. The Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation has guides for people in the U.S. where they can look up and say, you know, I live in this region of Ohio. What species should I be planting that will be most beneficial to butterflies and then also to other insects?
Eliza Grahams there, Assistant Professor in Biological Sciences at Binghamton University in New York, with some advice as to what we can all plant in our backyards or gardens or window boxes to try to encourage wildlife, including butterflies and insects there. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Denmark's state-run postal service, PostNord, says it's stopping the delivery of letters from the beginning of next year after around 400 years. It says the volume of letters has dropped a whopping 90% over the past couple of decades and it's no longer cost-effective. You will still be able to receive letters if they're posted as packages, but many fear it's older people that will be the worst affected, as many don't use email or other digital forms of communication. I've been speaking to Marlene Rieshoy-Cordes. She's from an organisation that advocates for the elderly. It's called Elder Segen. And her reaction was what when she found out this news?
I was concerned because in the DanAge organisation, we're organised in that way that we have many elderly members and we try to ensure that they have good conditions to living conditions in Denmark. And we know that many elderly are highly dependent on mail and physical mail delivery from the public regarding calls from the hospitals. If you need to go to the hospital, if you need to have a new look on your daycare,
right.
And you need to receive these letters and you have to respond on these letters.
Official letters like hospital appointments, and I guess also for some people, even things like household bills might still be sent through the mail.
Yeah, some, sure.
So what is the plan then in terms of how you can help people when this comes into effect? What's the way around this?
For now, we hear from official posts that there will be a change. So now you can still receive and send letters, but you have to send it as a package. Before, you would have like normal red mailboxes, and now they will be obsolete as well. So now you have to go somewhere else to a parcel shop to deliver your mail. Many of the elderly in Denmark live in rural cities, smaller cities where they have lived their whole life, are very happy and pleased to continue living there. But many of these shops are not located in their city, so they have to travel to the next one.
The problem is, though, that over the past 20 years, the number of letters and pieces of mail that have been sent through the Danish post, PostNord, has dropped.
But the digitalization of Denmark has been very rapidly. We still have this small amount of people, approximately 5% of the population, who has been, they don't have to accept digital mail. That is one of the things that nobody has really foreseen. You could go back to phone calls and calling people. It's nice also to have it written down. It can be very confusing just to have it on a phone call.
Culturally, how is this going to change things in Denmark? I mean, you know, for years people wrote letters or cards or Christmas cards, birthday cards. Is that all going to change now in Denmark?
It already has changed because last year when the monopoly of PostNord disappeared, the prices went up. previously it was about £1, the price of sending a Christmas card, and it rose to £1.5. Many of our members and many of the elderly were very sad because one of their communication lines in the past has always been writing greetings. Sending mail has been also a way of fighting loneliness, which is also a very big problem in Denmark. We are having more and more lonely people in all over the country. And if you live in a rural area and you have difficulties getting out of your house, and it's even more difficult to communicate with others because it's primarily now digitalized, it will be a loss for these people.
Marlene Rishøi-Cordes from an organization that advocates for the elderly in Denmark. Now, we've been speaking about the strained relations between Canada and the United States this hour. Well, now, many say this relationship has been captured in the natural world. A photograph has gone viral. It's of a Canada goose, the emblem of Canada, of course, and the bald eagle, a great symbol of American power. And they're locked in a fight to the death. It was taken by Canadian photographer Mervyn Sekira, who told me how he came to take the picture.
So I was by the lake, and the lake was frozen as far as the eye could see. I'm usually out there with my camera trying to get some pictures of nature and wildlife. And I saw this bald eagle coming in, not entirely unusual because you see bald eagles there. But this one seemed to have had purpose. It focused on a goose that was way out on the ice and isolated from the other geese. And then it went in for the attack. This went on for about 20 minutes. The eagle attacked the goose. The goose defended itself as best it could. There were bouts one after another. They take a little break to sort of catch their breaths and decide what the next strategy would be. And after about 20 minutes, when I thought that it was over for the goose, because there were several times when the eagle had the goose in its talons, I thought it was all over for the goose. But the bald eagle just gave up and took off, and the goose lived on.
The goose got away. And, I mean, you are a wildlife photographer. You're out there often watching these things. And we've got to say, the bald eagle is an apex predator, isn't it? It's a killing machine. So in that battle, it would have had the upper claw, shall we say.
Oh, certainly. Their talons and their feet are as big as my hand.
Goodness.
Yeah, and all the goose has got is web feet and the wings to defend itself.
But the goose wouldn't give in and obviously had some sort of attitude that not today.
So true. I suppose it was the survival instinct that kicked in and it just had to fight on, and it did.
So, unsurprisingly, your photographs have gone viral, and I think a lot of that has to do with the political situation at the moment, because although Canada and the United States have always had a friendly sporting rivalry, now there is quite a hostile relationship between the two governments of the countries. Did that cross your mind as you were taking the photos?
Not when I was taking the photographs. When I was taking the photographs, I was looking at it from a naturalist point of view, from a photographer's point of view, which I always do. It was after I took the photographs and I heard people talk about them in the context of the political situation that I realized that there was so much more to those photographs than just what caught my eye.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your Canadian fellows, the fact that the goose got away, is that being seen as quite significant?
Certainly. It certainly is.
How are Canadians feeling after the past few weeks where relations between the two friendly countries seem to be quite politically strained and economically strained as well?
It's a very difficult time, and I think I'm seeing more and more Canada flags flying on houses and whatever else. So it is a difficult time, no question about it.
Canadian photographer Mervyn Sekira there, and I urge you to do a search for his pictures, which are absolutely fantastic, of a majestic eagle and a clever goose that managed to get away this time. That's it for this hour. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, I'm Rachel Wright, and on the Global News podcast, we're following the Emergency Defence Summit in Brussels to address Europe's security crisis. We bring you the top stories from BBC News twice a day on weekdays and daily at weekends. Search for the Global News podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.